This is WCOM LP. FM on 103.5 in the FM dial. And this is a special edition of Carborough Bookbeat. I'm Paul Nash, and Audrey is on vacation today. Today we have a special guest. He is a well-known author of books on astrology, hermetic astrology, I guess is what you call your things. His name is Robert Powell, and we are going to talk to him about his particular career as a writer, and I guess for lack of a better word, an esotericist. So, Robert, welcome to Carborough Bookbeat, and why don't you tell the audience a little bit about who you are?
Yes, I am. I was born in England, in Reading, England, in 1947, and grew up just outside of Reading, and attended university in the south of England in a town called Brighton. Attended Sussex University, studied mathematics there, and after my bachelor's degree in mathematics, I went on, did a master's degree there in statistics and probability theory. Graduated with a master's degree in 1969 and started right away in 1969 as a teacher of mathematics at what is now called Brighton University. At that time it was called Brighton Polytechnic, teaching mathematics for degree level students of computer science. And I was teaching mathematical background for that and probability theory. And during that time, I had a spiritual awakening. I had an encounter with an author who was also a lecturer there at the same institution, but he was in the arts faculty, and an author who's written a number of books on esoteric themes, Fred Gettings. And from this encounter, this awoke in me an interest for what we could call the invisible realm, what is not visible with our senses, but which is beyond sense perception. And this was the beginning of a long journey. One of the main interests which was awakened within me was to study astrology, and I realized that in order to get to the bottom of this, I had to study the whole history, going back to the time of the Egyptians and the Babylonians. And that's how I began work on my PhD thesis, History of the Zodiac.
So when you met Fred Gettings and became aware of his work, about how old were you then, chronologically?
Well, I was 22 years old at the time, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you were also, and you were a professor of mathematics and computer science at the time,
right? Right.
Okay. So you were going into the history of astrology. So you, what happened? How to follow that up?
Well, with the history of astrology, when you go back, of course, it becomes one with astronomy. So this is looking into the Babylonian origins, and I focused in particular upon the origin of the zodiac. And there are various different ideas about the zodiac. There's the astronomical zodiac, the zodiac that is currently in use in the West and in Western astrology, what is called the tropical zodiac. And then there is the zodiac that the astrologers in India use, the Vedic astrologers. They use something called the sidereal zodiac, sidereal meaning of the stars, so it's defined in relation to the stars, whereas the tropical zodiac in Western astrology is defined in relation to the cycle of the seasons, beginning with the vernal point, defining the beginning of Aries. And the astronomers use the astronomical zodiac, which is the constellations in the heavens, but divided unequally. So this interested me, where did these various definitions of the zodiac originate? And I was led back to the original definition of the zodiac, with the Babylonians, and that is the theme of my thesis, which has been published as a book, History of the Zodiac. And I was able to reconstruct the original Babylonian Zodiac. That is part of my thesis, at the same time as looking at the transmission of the Zodiac from culture to culture. So, as you can imagine, a huge theme.
Yes, it is. And it's still current. There's lots of stuff that's still going on about unpacking the what's happening with the Zodiac. So, as you said, this was part of an inner awakening, and there were probably other themes that were going on in your life, too, that represented this inner awakening and change in career. You want us to touch upon some of those?
Yes, well, when I was working on my PhD thesis, I was using the excellent library at the British Museum in London, where one of the, I think it's the third largest library in the world. And, of course, my attention was sometimes directed to other themes while I was engaged in this study. And I began to look at the tradition that goes back to Greek philosophers about life unfolding in seven-year periods. For some reason, my attention was drawn to that theme. And one day I was just, during my lunch break, wandering down Museum Street opposite the British Museum Library in London, and walked into a bookstore there, the Rudolf Steiner bookshop, and saw many interesting books there, and found that Rudolf Steiner had elaborated about this theme of life unfolding in seven-year periods as something central to his teaching, which is applied in education for a way of better understanding the development of the child. So I found this very, very interesting, and I began to read Steiner's works. And Steiner called himself a spiritual scientist. He was born in Austria in 1861 and died in Switzerland in 1925. Could describe him as a universal genius who began as a scientist but pioneered a whole new field, what he calls spiritual science, taking science and applying the methods of science to explore the invisible realms. And this was a tremendous discovery for me.
Yeah, well, Rudolf Steiner and his anthroposophy has been was definitely a major European development of out of theosophy, the Madame Blavatsky's a group that started in 1875. And I guess after she died, there was a variety of innovations in the European front. There was the Golden Dawn in England, and among other things, partly because theosophy became, I guess, saturated or captured, depending upon your point of view, by Indian metaphysics, and people weren't quite willing to become, quasi-Hindus. And of course, there was also the issue of the Raj that was going on, which I think was part of the underlying theme of the theosophical movement anyway. So, but Rudolf Steiner started out as a theosophist, and then I guess through his own psychic awakening, and also wanting to integrate the esoteric themes of Christianity in a more explicit way than Madame Blavatsky and an official theosophy ever did, created this anthroposophy. And I guess in some ways the very terms theosophy and anthroposophy shows one aspect of the shift, which I assume is from theocentricness to human-centricness, that we, as it were, have become the center of the cosmos. And now there are a number of movements within anthroposophy, one of which you alluded to is the Waldorf movement, which is the educational movement and is in some ways far outstripped even anthroposophy. Some people find anthroposophy by sending their kids to Waldorf schools, but I don't know if that's the chief way of recruitment for anthroposophy in the Americas or not. But one of the things that I became aware of your work was through a translation that you did of a work called Meditations on the Tarot. And it was an anonymous work. It was published without the author's name, though we know who the author is, and we'll discuss him in a minute. And can you say how that work came your way and how you ended up translating it?
Yes, well, through my encounter with the work of Rudolf Steiner, this led me to the work of the individual who wrote the book Meditations on the Tarot. And he had been, for a time, a follower of Rudolf Steiner. He was born in Russia in 1900 and became an anthroposophist at quite an early age and was lecturing on anthroposophical themes. He had to leave Russia because of the Bolshevik Revolution, came to Estonia and was active in Estonia, and then came from Estonia to Holland. And in Holland, he was very active, holding lectures. This remarkable individual, whose name is Valentin Tomberg, is the author of Meditations on the Tarot. And I was introduced to the book, to the manuscript of Meditations on the Tarot, by a Dutch woman living in Amsterdam who had known Valentin Tomberg personally. And when I met her, I met her at the beginning of the year 1978, and she gave me a very large French manuscript, about 600 pages, and said to me, "You are the one to translate this from French into English." So I took this task on, and it was an incredible work and really an extraordinary opening up for me to the whole world of a living esotericism that I found in this book, Meditations on the Tarot, which then was finally published 7 years later after I received the manuscript, was finally published in 1985 here in the United States and has gone through several editions since then, and is currently available through the edition that was published by Jeremy Tarcher of Putnam. So it's found its way to this, which I believe is one of the largest publishers in the world, Putnam, Penguin Putnam. And this book is really something that can open up for anyone who reads it a totally new perspective on life itself. So,
now you came across the manuscript some years after the author had actually passed away. Then, so you actually never met the author. Though one of the things that comes around in the folklore of this book, and I have read the book and actually led study groups on this particular book, Meditations on the Tarot. But one of the things that exists sort of in the things is his appearance to the people. There are a couple of literary accounts in which he's actually come and manifested after his death and in various ways. In one case, it was somebody browsing in a metaphysical bookstore, which almost could have been me. And this old guy comes up to him and says, "Well, you should read this book." And then the finding that this fellow may or may not have been who he was, it could have been a manifestation of Tomberg and his and it is a remarkable book. I mean, it's a remarkable esoteric book. It was featured in the encyclopedic dictionary of occultism, which is a major reference book on European esotericism. And the And I agree with you. It is a remarkable attempt of synthesis of bringing in and on an orthodox way, because Tomberg himself, in his own personal career, had converted to a version of pre-Vatican II Catholicism. And one of the astounding things about his book is that a famous, although up until relatively recently obscure theologian wrote an afterword to his book, which has been published in the latter editions. And what was the name of that?
The theologian's name is Hans Urs von Balthasar,
right.
Swiss theologian who is regarded by very many in the Catholic world as the leading Catholic theologian of the 20th century. At the end of his life, he was made a cardinal by Pope John Paul II, and he thoroughly endorsed the book Meditations on the Terror, which is an extraordinary thing. And that endorsement actually has opened up for many Catholics the possibility of reading this book and becoming introduced to very profound esoteric ideas.
And what we're talking about here is we're talking about degrees of Christianity that in some forms of churchianity would be looked at with suspect. Basically, we're looking at the Renaissance view. We're looking at how Christianity is integral to the great civilization from which it emerged, which includes astrology, and it includes esotericism of music, and a whole many other themes, which usually, Tomberg very much saw within a sacramental framework that for him was best represented in Catholicism.
Yes, he was a profound mystic, but beyond that, he was in a living connection with spiritual realms, and I think this is what comes to expression in the various accounts that people have given of him appearing to them years after his death, as the story you mentioned, which is reported by the New York psychiatrist Gerald Epstein in his book Beyond Immortality, I think is the title.
Yeah.
Which Gerald Epstein describes his encounter with this extraordinary being in a metaphysical bookstore who introduced him to his book, Meditations on the Terror, and there are other accounts as well. And as the translator of this book into English, I've met many people in different countries who have expressed their profound gratitude to me, saying that reading this book, Meditations on the Terror, has changed their lives. It has opened up something for them which they never knew of before. And just from those kind of accounts, one can grasp this is an extraordinary book which goes far beyond what we find usually in the literature on the tarot. Meditations on the Tarot is taking the tarot cards as profound symbols of esoteric truths coming all the way from ancient Egypt, so-called Hermetic tradition, going back to the great teacher of the Egyptians, Hermes, also known as Hermes Trismegistus. And Tomberg's endeavor with the book Meditations on the Tarot was a kind of fusion of this ancient Hermetic tradition of the Egyptian mystery wisdom with Christianity. And his impulse was clearly one of, on the one hand, helping Catholics to come to esoteric knowledge, on the one hand, and on the other hand, of enabling the truths of esotericism to be integrated into the history of Christianity through the Catholic Church.
One of the things that Tomberg does is that most historians know that the tarot is, for all intents and purposes, and playing cards generally, appears in Europe around the time of the printing press, not much before. And that apparently the tarot itself, which is known for the special set of cards or suit, which is called the Major Arcana, and that's the part of the deck that Tomberg is primarily concerned with writing his commentary about, these are 22 cards that are most notable. They start out with the Fool, usually, and then the Magician, the High Priestess, the Empress, the Emperor, and so on, through to the world at the end of the deck. And it's has also often been portrayed by Tarot as a sort of stages of the spiritual life, 22 stages to the spiritual life. Now, Tomberg's work goes way beyond that in terms of what he does with the commentary and integrating it. For one thing, he does integrate it with the sacramental life of Catholicism, which is profound in its own right. And then he relates it to various degrees, you could say almost degrees of expertise. Like when my reading of it, I know my biases, you know. I'm a mystic. One of my biases of mysticism. And Tomberg deals with mysticism in its highest sense in the first card of the Magician, in which he really talks about the whole point of what meditation is. And the whole point of meditation is realizing the complete unity of consciousness in its most profound and simple form that's within ourselves is none other than the actual divine in its profoundest presence, and that this is realized usually through degrees, but he does bring out the apophatic or the non-imaged view of this thing. So he uses images in a very profound way, and he also has a deep, profound effect for the conceptualizable aspects of the depth of what the esoteric vision is. And usually you don't run into a book that starts off at some of the deepest layers of what the purpose of meditation is. And then he goes from there to show something which I had never really appreciated before, which is with the High Priestess, where in the High Priestess he talks about a gnosis. And here is not gnosis in the sense of Gnosticism, as a specific religious trend in the late antique world, but gnosis as the kind of knowledge that arrives from this deep, profound meditative insight. The meditative insight, which is ultimately formless begins to take a kind of form in a symbolic way with the High Priestess. But even then, as I used to say, is gnosis as knowledge of unity. In other words, using the word gnosis, the Greek pronunciation for knowledge, was emphasizing the unitiveness of knowledge with awareness rather than the separateness of knowledge, which would be symbolic and derivative, which would be a different kind. Of course, he then goes on with the Empress to bring in the natural symbols and stuff. So he goes through all the major arcana, giving them profoundly original and yet germane redefinitions of what they could symbolize in terms of the spiritual path. And this is why people are quite astounded by the book, because one of the things it does is it can make a living presence to religious forms that may otherwise seem contrived, dead, or historically accidental. Well, that's my view of how the book affected me. Now, you've lived with this book and being its translator and being either blamed for it or otherwise since for the last 25 years. And so what's your two levels? What's your own experience been of the work and how has it grown in you and how has it maybe affected directions in terms of your own spiritual development and the kinds of things you do now, which we want to talk about, and the and also how other people have come to told you or expressed to you their own views of what the meditations in the Tarot. So,
yes, well, I agree with you that this way of approaching the symbols of the Tarot is extraordinarily profound and brings completely new perspectives and is actually like an active stimulation of one's own spiritual life. This has been my experience over these past 30 years or so of knowing the book, actually 32 years now, and I've read the book very many times, at least a dozen times, and each time it I discover new things, which is quite amazing. So that really conveys that it's a living book. And when I say discover, this is something, it's like a process within me, which is a process of awakening. I'd say it's a book one can live with for many, many years, and it keeps on growing within one. It's a growing body of knowledge. If I were to be sent off to a desert island and I could take only one book, I think that's the book I would take because it's a magical book. And there is a secondary work which I'd also like to mention called The Wandering Fool, that's in relation to the tarot card The Fool. The Wandering Fool was published last year. Contains three lectures that I've given about the content of this book, and it also contains notes made by the author, Valentin Tomberg, as his preliminary studies before writing Meditations on the Tarot. And these notes really help us to understand what kind of process he was going through when he was writing this book. And what is perhaps also helpful to know is that he indicated to the woman who gave me the manuscript, and she kept contact with him until the end of his life. He indicated to her that this was really a sacred commission, I guess one could call it, from higher realms, from the world of spirit, that he undertake this work. He was very much guided in the writing of it. And part of the commission was to write the book in French, although that was not his mother language. His mother language was Russian. He was very fluent in German, in Dutch, and he lived in England for the latter part of his life, so he was very fluent also in English. But he took it upon himself to write this in French because that was part of the commission from the world of spirit that he do this. So if any listener is interested in following up further on Meditations on the Tarot and its background, I can recommend the book The Wandering Fool that came out last year, 2009. And it covers many different perspectives. And one of the most important perspectives I just would like to mention briefly is the theme that comes up in the very first Arcanum of chapter of Meditations on the Tarot, and that is in relation to the Church of Peter and the Church of John. And this is one aspect which runs through the book in a hidden way, that the Church of John, what we could call the esoteric church, is holding the mysteries of the heights and the depths of Christianity, which became lost from the Exeter Church, known as the Church of Peter. And we can see, when we understand the content of Meditations on the Tarot, which is an expression of these mysteries of the heights and the depths, we can see that it's an endeavor to integrate the esoteric Church of John with the exoteric Church of Peter. I think this is a very important aspect of this book, and the author makes it clear that there is not really an intrinsic enmity between the two. Obviously, there needs to be a lot of healing that takes place between exoteric church and the whole field of esotericism, but intrinsically there is not an enmity, at least not from the individuals of Peter and John, who are the primary figures representing these two streams.
Yeah, or one level is that magicians may fight with one another, but mystics, for the most part, basically agree upon loving God. and don't necessarily. And this is definitely one way of understanding the mystical side of the religion, which is probably the side that gives the thing life. Of course, life needs form, it needs body, it needs certain types of sustenances, and that is the stone of Peter, in a way. And so they're complementary rather than antagonistic. There are an incredible number of themes in Meditations on the Tarot, if one has an interest, specifically. I've noticed that in my invitation for having people read the Tarot, I found that there were a number of people, people with a Christian background, for the most part, found it okay, but there were two types of people. This is being a little simplistic. I found people who had a very strong Jewish background sort of fell away from it because it didn't seem to speak enough to their own background or whatnot. And the other people were the neo-pagans. And in terms of the popularity of Tarot, at least in America and probably to some degree Europe, neo-paganism of one sort or another has adapted Tarot as an oracle of choice. And there are many Tarot decks that are developed with very specific sort of naturalistic fantastic things. They seem to be comfortable adapting aspects of esotericism into this neo-pagan view, particularly Grail legend things, but anything that might bring in the goddess and make it more present. But speaking of the goddess, and also speaking of esotericism, from your own continuation, it is the divine feminine that seems to have been taken hold of your own tale, as it were. And I know that it does. It is one of the themes in Meditations. But how did that evolve? How did this evolve in your founding of the Sophia Foundation?
Yes, well, when I went to Amsterdam and had the meeting with the woman who introduced me, who gave me the manuscript of Meditations on the Tarot, on that same occasion, she accompanied me to a little chapel in Amsterdam where in 1951, it wasn't just in 1951, it was over a period of several years, but the primary appearance was in 1951, where there was an appearance of the Virgin Mary. And when I went to that chapel, I had a profound experience of the Divine Feminine, which for me came in the form of Sophia, Divine Wisdom. Sophia is the Greek word for wisdom. We usually understand wisdom as an abstract concept, but if we read the book of Proverbs, for example, in the Old Testament, we find there that Sophia, wisdom, actually speaks, addresses us in the first person. It's clear that that wisdom, or Sophia, is an actual being who is part of of God's creation and holds the divine plan, which is the, say, the matrix of creation, the wisdom of creation.
So just in term, just for chronology's sake, well, do you remember what year that was that you went to the chapel and had this experience?
It was 1980. It was actually 2 years after I'd received the manuscript in 1978. Yeah.
And so you were working on it still then?
Right.
Yeah.
I was still translating at that point. And what drew me to visit that chapel was, in translating Meditations on the Tarot, there is a whole chapter or on the 11th Arcanum, which is entitled Force, which is really about the Divine Feminine. And in that chapter, the author mentions this visitation, this appearance of Virgin Mary in 1951, and describes it as an authentic apparition of Mary, which happened there in Amsterdam. And as I was there in Amsterdam, of course, I wanted to visit that chapel, and that was a life-changing experience for me.
That is amazing. So, so in the process of getting this together, when was it then that you founded the Sophia Foundation? And I guess what's its program? You know, what is it? If people look up the Sophia Foundation on the internet, you know, who is it for, and what does it do? What's its mission?
So, arising from this initial mystical experience relating to Sophia, I chose to dedicate my life to Sophia and to the Divine Feminine, and this led then to important meetings for me. One was with Karen Rivers in Northern California, from San Rafael, Northern California. And through our mutual interest, this led at the end of the year 1994 to the founding of the Sophia Foundation of North America, with the intention of forming a community of those people who feel drawn to Sophia and the Divine Feminine, to represent Sophia in the world. So if anybody goes to our website, sophiafoundation.org, they will find what we are about, which is that we have various events, courses, we offer meditation courses, we offer workshops, and Sophia is the overriding theme in these workshops. And my own particular interest is in developing new forms of coming to an experience of Sophia, not just coming to an understanding of Sophia, although that, of course, in itself is very interesting, what we could call the theology of Sophia, or Sophiology as it's called, but finding ways of helping people to come to an actual experience.
Well, probably you have stumbled across Henri Corbin's writings, because
yes,
he is one that highly developed the things. I'm going to throw in a few biographical asides, just out of curiosity, if people are wondering about this. We're about approximately the same age, and just out of curiosity, I was born in 47. Just got under the wire, though. My own religious awakening was in 1967, and was very profound. And it was basically, it was sort of like, it was sort of a recognition that enlightenment was real. And it became, for me, without going into any digressive things, it became an inner touchstone for me. I went through many groups and so forth. In fact, I was an anthropologist for years, and deliberately was looking at the new religious groups. And in that process of being an anthropologist, I became initiated into Wicca and discovered and found personally that I needed the goddess. I recognized that this was an important dissertatum for myself mystically. And so for me, my initiation into Wicca was in 1978. So there's, in 1980, I was studying Mujahideen Ibn Arabi in England. And had strong, profound experiences with him. So I don't want to go too much more into that, but specifically there is an interesting parallelism between your own unfoldment and discovering the goddess. You've taken it in an interesting way. I've been very happy and spent most of the 80s starting and introducing people into Wicca. And then basically bowed out of it and haven't been an active Wiccan for years, though, I still have plenty of Wiccan friends, as it were. But I do think that metaphysically, for all sorts of reasons, ecological, psychological, and so forth, the emergence of the divine feminine is so fundamental to our time and age and things, that any attempt to make it less than what it is just you're just not in tune with what's going on. People who are resisting the divine feminine, and of course, I think this is obviously understood on a popular level, just because of that mass bestseller we had a few years ago, that brought in the idea of Mary Magdalene, the revaluation of Magdalene as the consort of Jesus, which is hardly an orthodox idea when it comes to Christianity. But we very much need a divine that represents both genders. And in a lot of ways, it's because we haven't had a divine representing both genders that we can see some of the imbalance that our civilization represents. So with that aside, let's get into your specific mission as far as the Sophia Foundation goes.
Yes, Paul, well, that is really very well said, that our modern civilization really needs the divine feminine perspective, which is a heart perspective, and it is a caring perspective, a loving perspective, caring for Mother Earth or the goddess or however we like to call this beautiful planet that we live on and which is now severely suffering through what we could describe as the machine assault upon Mother Earth. And we can think of various catastrophes at the current time where the awakening of human beings on a heart level to begin truly caring for our planet as a living being. This is at the heart of the work of the Sophia Foundation. We could say awakening to Mother Earth as a living being on the one hand, and also expanding our awareness to our community with the starry heavens. Awakening to the earth on the one hand, awakening to the reality of the cosmos, the starry heavens, on the other hand, and through this having an expansion of consciousness. So Sophia for me has to do with these two sides, this awakening to the starry heavens, to the wisdom of creation that we find expressed in astronomy, in astrology, and what my own field is astrosophy, taking astrology a stage further. Astrosophia would be the wisdom of the stars. And on the other hand, the awakening to Mother Earth. And the third aspect of the divine feminine, which is very, very important too, is what we could call the divine feminine aspect of the soul of the world, and the soul of humanity, which is to come to the realization that humanity is one great family. We are one family in Sophia, who we could describe as the mother of humanity, and we need to feel our kinship with all peoples of the earth, and out of that, a growing love for all peoples of the earth. That will help to overcome the problems in our current world with war and hostility and so on.
Well, it's a profound vision, and I think what in some ways to tie this back around into this similar way that the Meditations in the Tarot as a book invites a person into this cosmic vision. It's basically seeing that everything somehow fits together. And the more and more we move closer and closer to our authentic source, the more we see how all things, as it were, dance with one another or move with one another. And nothing is alone. Everything is profoundly connected in ways that we usually don't recognize and see. And I think that perhaps having had an opportunity to watch a class you just did, that there are ways that we can profoundly recognize this connection in very simple ways, through simple dance movements, through simple recitations of poetry in a liturgical context, in making beauty, you know, a flower arrangement. You know, there's all sorts of ways that we participate in and that we recognize this profound interconnection, cosmic connection.
Exactly, Paul, and that is what I was addressing, that finding ways of coming to an experience of Sophia and the Divine Feminine. And this is what I have developed. I call it Choreocosmos, Cosmic Dance. And this is a way of, through dance, through very simple dance movements to classical music, to bring to expression the different cosmic configurations. For example, what you just saw with the group I was teaching today, we were working with Moon in Aquarius, Venus in Aquarius, and so on. And this can be very, very profound and touching, reawakening our sense of kinship with the cosmos. So it's going beyond an intellectual appreciation of the wholeness to coming into a living experience of our relatedness to the whole of creation. So Choreocosmos, coming from the Greek, meaning cosmic dance, is an expression of, or a path to Sophia, to the Divine Feminine. Many people around the world are drawn to this. I'm traveling constantly, teaching in the United States and Canada, in Germany, Italy, Sweden, in Australia. And there are communities that have formed doing the Choreocosmos, cosmic and sacred dance. And we also work with meditation to sacred texts and music. I call this the Sophia Grail Circle. This is another way we can come into a living connection with the Divine Feminine and with Sophia, who is the mother of humanity and holds the matrix of creation. That really expresses what this work of the Sophia Foundation of North America is about.
Well, you know, if you're Joe Blow off the street, as it were, and I've read a few books on astrology or something, who, now, I guess the question is, who's going to be ready to accept this invitation? Because it would seem that you know, I've spent my years studying religious things, so I'm not Mr. Typicality, but the question is. Who becomes attracted to this the Sophia way, your particular path? Who are these people? How do they find you? And what kinds of stirrings? We're not talking necessarily stirrings of the intellect. You know, you're not going to run into a bunch of philosophers who have no sense of their own body or emotions, but who's likely to hear this message?
Well, people from all walks of life, actually, who are seeking, who have burning thirst for truth and beauty and goodness and are looking for a new way. We see this work as creating culture for the future, and although it's relatively small at the present time, we see this as a work for the future, for our whole civilization, to awaken to the beauty of creation and what is possible to create together when we come together as a group dedicated to the divine feminine, to Sophia and to the...
So in that way, you could say it's extra religious. You could be a Jew and do this, and you could be a Buddhist and do this, and so forth.
Oh, yes, we have people from all different religious directions, and Sophia is universal. We find Sophia in all the different world religions in different names, as Kuan Yin in the Chinese Buddhism, as Sarasvati in Hinduism, as Tara in Tibetan Buddhism, as Shekinah in Jewish mysticism. So the name Sophia is an expression of the divine feminine who appears in under different names and guises in the different world religions. So anybody could participate.
Another aspect that we haven't had a chance to deal too much with, but I know is important, is the angelic realms. And so I think the best way to understand angelic in a general sense for somebody who doesn't study this stuff is you have the divine, which is so profound and so simple as not to have a face, not to be something that can be quite seen or grasped. It's so pervasive, and yet at the same time, what the angelic presences do is to present aspects of divinity in a way that is acceptable or recognizable to us. You know, in other words, what is the message for? The message is not for the person who's stating the message. The message is for the person who's hearing the message. And so, and angels are wrapped up in their attentiveness to the divine, but as messengers, they adapt to our ears, as it were. And I do know that you do work with this. So how does the angelic aspects work?
Well, part of the Choreocosmos school, we have an actual training for people to teach Choreocosmos school. There is also a branch of the Choreocosmos school here in North Carolina, in this area, the East Coast Choreocosmos school.
And actually, I guess it's towards the end of July that you usually have a workshop here every year.
Yes, usually the last week in July.
So if you're interested, folks, you can contact me through Carborough BookBeat, and I will forward your email or your inquiry on to the people who are organizing that event.
And it's also possible through the Sophia Foundation website. One can just find the information on the Sophia Foundation website.
And that's called sophiafoundation.com, right?
.org.
Yeah.
So to come back to your question with the angelic presences, this is something that is also addressed in the book Meditations on the Tarot, where the author points out that each human being has a guardian angel who really cares for the destiny and the life of each human being with whom they are responsible for, and that part of the awakening, spiritual awakening, is to awaken to this level of reality from which we can receive guidance in all aspects of our daily life, that once one becomes aware of one's guardian angel, it is possible to receive guidance. And in the Kairocosmos work, we work very intensively with this awakening to the angelic realm, which we see in connection with the whole solar system and with the cosmos surrounding us, that there are higher beings, higher intelligences. And in fact, if we begin to study the astronomy in all its profundity, we come to the realization that there is an intelligent design. There is a higher intelligence at work in the laws of planetary motion and in the laws governing our whole galaxy. This we are working with in the Kairocosmos school, to become aware of this, what we could call higher intelligences or angelic intelligences.
And this is to become aware of them at a very visceral level, at a very deep level. That's not necessarily, we're not interested necessarily in opinion or dogma, but rather in, I guess, direct experience to some degree.
Exactly. Well, in the Kairocosmos activity, we're working with gesture, for example, and this is a whole alphabet. We could say it's like the, you could call it the language of the angels, if you will, and so this is what we are endeavoring to learn.
Well, I one of the things that I think is interesting is that the message of Marcino Ficino, who was the scholar who was basically supported by Lorenzo the Magnificent, the Medici thing in Florence. He was the one who translated Plato into Latin. But before he translated Plato, he translated the Corpus Hermeticum, the writings of Hermes Trismegistus. And it's this hermeticism, which is a kind of bridge between Christianity and paganism, that we have a version of esoteric Christianity, of hermeticism, that all of the religions ultimately are one. And I think that was the vision of in the long run of Thunberg and his Meditations on the Tarot. All religions are one, and that, and in some ways we need to become more serious about what our religions can do, because we need their guidance, and we need to reform ourselves in a way that we can remake our civilizations, so we don't need to necessarily terribly suffer because of a civilizations that are hidebound in anti-sustainable technologies and other forms of pain and injustice that we that our civilization inflicts upon ourselves and upon the core of the earth.
Yes. So if I could just add there, yeah, that the work Meditations on the Tarot is, as you say, to build this bridge between Christianity and in fact, including all the world religions. And it also builds a bridge between science and spirituality. That is my own experience, coming from a scientific background. And through this work, the opening, the awakening to the reality of the spirit. So that is also something incredibly important for our time. We consider the very powerful influence of science upon the whole of our modern culture.
Well, I really want to thank you, Robert, for hanging out with me for this hour and having an opportunity to discuss a very interesting book called Meditations on the Tarot. If you are somebody who's of a mind that wants to explore these things, this is an interesting, this is a real interesting book, which may, if you read it with some attention, may change your mind and change your life. It definitely did this with Robert Powell and his work. And even I, as resistant as I may be, have found Mr. Tomberg somebody to pay attention to. So thank you. You've been listening to Carborough BookBeat, and we'll be with you next week with another show. Thank you, Robert.
Thank you very much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.